Welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast, featuring interviews with incredible working artists who are also mothers and compelling conversations regarding parenting and the art world. These conversations create a space for inclusivity and support for artist mothers worldwide. I'm Kaylin Butine, painter, mom of three, and podcast host. I'm so grateful you are tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
Now I think about what it would be like to have another child, and I really swing back and forth about whether or not I'd want to do that, because I think of how lucky I am to have a full life, not thinking about disability or disease for a second. But I don't want to slow down or give anything else up, because something to make room, at least when I think about it in the abstract, something has to go away.
It's my pleasure to welcome Sarah J. Winston to the Artist Mother Podcast today. Sarah is an artist based in New York. She works with photographs, text, and book forms to describe and respond to chronic illness and its ongoing impact on her body, her mind, her family, and her memory. Sarah is the author of several photo books, among them Foibles and Avoidance, a National Monument Press, Shades from Push-Pull Editions, A Lick and a Promise from Candor Arts, and Homesick from Zatara Press. Sarah is Artist in Residence and Photography Program Coordinator at Bard College, on the faculty and 2025 Acting Chair of the Penumbra Foundation Long-Term Photo Book Program, a contributor to Lens Scratch and the Photo Eye blog, where she writes about photo books, and a member of Storm King Art Center's Accessibility Advisory Group. On June 29th, 2023, her long-term project about multiple sclerosis care, Our Body is a Clock, was adapted and published as an op-ed in the New York Times titled, My Body is a Clock, The Private Life of Chronic Care. Sarah, we have a lot to talk about. I'm so glad that you're here to share in this conversation about artist parenthood, chronic illness, and all the things. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Kaylin.
Yes. So I just wanted to start at the top of this interview to share how I was introduced to your work, because I feel like it's maybe like a little bit of a unique story. After I first heard about you, I then had seen like your New York Times article circulating and stuff, but I came across your work in Richmond, Virginia, when I was there visiting an artist friend, a couple artist friends, and we walked into Candela Gallery, which is a photo-based gallery in Richmond, Virginia, and Candela, I can't think of the guy director's name there, but he is a pretty amazing photo book producer. You know his name.
Gordon.
Hi, Gordon. Shout out to Gordon. and yeah, just, you know, they have this stunning photo book collection that's like a part of the legacy of the gallery and the work that Gordon does. And I just, you know, I think they had two of your books there. And I immediately like picked them up and was like, oh, is this an artist mother? Because I really want to interview her. Her photographs are so stunning. I wanted to know more about your work. So I just thought it was, you know, a fun little way to share how we connected, because, you know, you never know when people are going to come across your work. And, yeah, it was really lovely to see it in that format.
That's so nice to hear, because when you wrote to me, of course, you mentioned that you'd been at Candela, and I thought it was Shades during the recent Unbound exhibition, but it hadn't occurred to me that the book collection, people can look at the books in the collection. It's not just a collection that is being built as part of the legacy, but that it is an actively viewable collection. So the other one would have been A Lick and a Promise from 2017.
Yes, there was the, I'm not sure which one, but I know one, there was like a collaborative partner that was highly visible in the book as well.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, in this moment, the name is escaping me of the artist, but because I walked into Candela, there's another artist who I loved her photo book, and I actually curated her into a show at Kin House. I know she's going to listen to this, and I'm so sorry for forgetting your name in the moment. I'll come back and put it in the show notes, but it's just, yeah, you know, those little things where we think as an artist, we just don't know where our work is going to get picked up and where those connections are going to be made. But anyway, shout out to Candela, to Gordon, to Sarah Irvin, my artist friend in Richmond, and, you know, all the little moments that build our careers, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Sarah,
and Whitney and Ashby of Candela, who put so much hard work into making the Unbound show happen every year.
Yes. Big shout out to all the staff and directors at Candela. Sarah, I want to focus on you now, of course, but thanks for letting me take us down that path to start. Would love for you to share a bit about your childhood that, you know, helps connect to your life as an artist today. I'm always so curious to know if artists were introduced to art as a child beyond just kind of the here's a box of crayons kid, you know, or if you found your way to art through a different path.
It's a really interesting question because now I'm investigating everything about my childhood through being a parent to mm-hmm. a five-year-old. But I was encouraged to do a lot of creative expression as a kid. Like my mom signed me up for sewing classes when I was probably six. And I went to a Montessori school until first grade. And it was all about, I mean, primarily about social emotional stuff. And a lot of that is expressing oneself through all kinds of art. But other than those kind of crafty modes, I think there wasn't a lot of art in my upbringing. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I went, maybe it was fifth grade growing up in the metropolitan New York area. We went to the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Mm.
I don't know what we went to see there. But I think that was my first exposure to art with a capital A. And then I have a sibling who is 9 years older than me.
Okay.
And when he took a photography class in high school, I was really envious of the amount of attention and time he and my mom were spending together and the amount of attention that my brother was getting and being shown how to use this camera. And so when it was my turn to take that class in high school, I had the same teacher as my brother. And I think that was the first time that I really, I don't know, it wasn't really about art in the way that it is for me now, but I was just so stunned and amazed by the process of developing film and making a print in the darkroom that I couldn't really imagine anything else doing anything else. Mm. And I was given a lot of freedom for better and worse to be on my own as an adolescent. So I was able to explore and figure out what I wanted and what I wanted to, pursue. Yeah.
Mm. And then, so from that point, went on to further your education in art, and you kind mm-hmm. of picked the path from that first exposure.
Yeah, I took that photography class, I think, as a senior in high school.
Okay.
And I ended up becoming interested in the idea of photojournalism. And so I looked at two schools that offered that as a specific course of study. And I ended up going to an art school in Washington, D.C. Because they gave me a really great financial offer, scholarship mm. offer. And it was known as the Corcoran College of Art and it doesn't exist anymore. It was absorbed by George Washington University. But what among the things that were so valuable about it is that it was a school inside of a museum.
Mm.
And so we had almost unlimited access to the museums during the closed hours. We had 24-hour access to the labs, and we could go up and see the exhibitions when there was no one around. And so I think in addition to the wealth of resources that are available in Washington, D.C., all of the Smithsonian museums are free.
Mm.
I got to spend a lot of really intimate time in the galleries. And the shows that were most memorable to me, there was a myelin show when I first started there in 2007. And they were small models and drawings of water. And then later that year, there was an Avedon exhibition, and it was the first time I saw Avedon's murals.
Mm-hmm.
And among the most memorable was that was how I became aware of the Chicago Seven and that kind of radical politics, which really blew my mind.
Mm.
And then there was a really incredible William Eggleston show that went to travel on to New York afterward, but it showed his most iconic pictures and then films and books. And, you know, I now work at a liberal arts school and I see what I missed out on getting like a better view of what the students here do. But I think that it's always a trade because I really got to learn from both practicing artists who are dedicated educators and also directly from being in the museum setting and seeing people pull things out of cold storage or seeing the preparators work alongside the students. And like, it was very exciting and vibrant. And there was a real pulse to that place.
I bet. And that art handling and kind of behind the scenes, like crafting an exhibition, like those are all things that even adult artists, so many of us have little exposure to, you know? So really cool that you had that in your, you know, in the beginning of your artist development. Sarah, I want you to share a little bit about your work, kind of describing it for those maybe who are being introduced to you for the first time. And you mentioned you have a 5-year-old child. Do you have just one child or do you, I can't remember if you have multiple. Okay.
Just one.
Yep. Yeah. So can you describe your work and your practice a bit?
Yes. So for the past 10 years, I have really focused on self-portraiture, and that has taken a few pathways. I've photographed myself alone in hospital settings. In 2015, I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and that really changed the vision and the track of my life. And I started receiving medical infusions, so medicine by IV every 28 days. Mm. And for the first 5 years of that treatment, I was using my iPhone to kind of look down at the site where the needle would go into my body. And then after my daughter was born, I started using a tripod and a remote. Mm. And at first I was doing that at home, and then I realized I could do that pretty easily in the hospital. So I started to. Mm-hmm. And in that shift of using the tripod and the remote, I was photographing in the hospital, but then a few months later, the pandemic started and a series of events led to my spouse, my kid, and I moving into my childhood home, and I would photograph my daughter and my mom and me every day as a bonding activity, but a creative process, a creative act where it was something that helped pass the time and helped really the interpersonal relationship that had felt kind of strained because of politics and differences in our politics between my parents and me. So each day we would sort of heal whatever had happened the day before by coming together and making a picture. And then I continued to photograph myself with just my daughter and me, occasionally my husband. And I was doing that every day until more recently. It's become a little bit harder. Mm. So in a lot of my work, I appear as a character.
Mm-hmm. And these are documentary style photographs that you're composing, would you say staging or not?
Yeah, I would say staging. Yeah. There's definitely a documentary photography language to the aesthetics of the pictures. Mm-hmm. But usually when I talk about the work, I say that it's not a documentary project by any means, because they are staged moments. The way that I have learned to set up the camera, it's usually horizontal on the tripod, and I'll look through my camera's viewfinder to decide what the background will be. Mm. Before I started making self-portraits, I was really making still lives of objects in like a home. Mm-hmm. And so I have what I think of as a nice sense of organizing space. And so when I started making the self-portraits, I'd take that sense of organizing space and think of it as a stage. And then I'd move around within the rectangle of that stage, having an awareness of about where on each side. And at first I was just using the timer on my camera, a digital camera. And then I got a remote on my phone, an app. And then I got a remote object. Mm-hmm. And I just tried lots of different methods of figuring out how it would work. But it took a long time to, I would say, master the process. Mm. And it's really just been an ongoing practice where noticing the light or noticing a moment that might be special or interesting. And I think really why I started making those pictures is that I couldn't really imagine what it looked like to be a patient in the hospital in this capacity over and over and over, or to be somebody's child and somebody's parent living in my childhood home. Mm-hmm. That didn't feel very good emotionally. Mm. Or really like the struggles of having an infant toddler and no support, or also like, what is the cliche people say? There's no rule book with raising kids. Mm-hmm. I was like, what does that actually look like?
Yeah. I think the problem with assigning a rule book is that every kid is so different. You know, we're all human beings. We're not, I don't know, machines or something to program, right?
Yeah. Maybe it's manual. Maybe that's what my mom always says. Like, there's no manual.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think parenting is, you know, you just learn by doing. Like, you can read all the books, but until you're practicing it, it's just like the learning doesn't really happen in the same way. Lots to unpack there. I want to go back. There's things that I want to talk about related to your art practice and photo books and photography, but maybe first to add a bit more context. You were diagnosed with MS in 2015. Is that what you said? And your daughter is 5. So you like you knew of your diagnosis before you had your daughter. And yeah, I'm bringing that up because I have so many conversations with artist parents who really hesitate to have children because they don't want to give up, you know, their art practice, or they don't see how they could do both, carry the weight of both identities, wear both hats. Curious about your perspective of maybe some of those anxieties coupled with the fact that, you know, you have a chronic illness that you're managing, and I don't know.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, even before I started experiencing acute symptoms of MS, and for people who are listening, multiple sclerosis is a disease of the central nervous system that affects or can affect all body systems. So each person with MS has a different experience of the disease. There are three different types, I think, of progressive illness. And then the most common is relapsing remitting MS, which is what I have. So there are periods of active disease and periods of remission where there's no disease activity. And my first symptoms were numbness and tingling, but not just like, oh, your leg's asleep, kind of tingling, mm-hmm. but persistent, very strong kind of pins and needles that verge on numbness. Split one half of my body, not the other. Mm. And what was the most alarming was that it was half of my tongue, half of the back of my throat. I could feel it behind my eye. So it was pretty alarming. I didn't really know if it would just go away in a few days or not. And then I've also had issues with my vision and issues with the dexterity I have in my right hand, stiffness, heaviness, pain. But there are really sophisticated medicines to treat symptoms and to keep the disease in remission. And because I was 26 when I was diagnosed, mm-hmm. I was able to start being treated shortly after, and I've been really fortunate. But before all of that mishigas, I didn't really see myself becoming a parent. Mm-hmm. I just didn't envision it in my life when I just sort of would fantasize about my future. But then I met someone who did see a future with children in it, and we got married. And I think I said, if I were to get pregnant, I think I'd want to see that pregnancy to term and have a baby. And then about a month later, I was pregnant. and I think I'd had a conversation with one of my specialists who had said to me that if I did see my future as one with children, it'd be best for my condition to do it at a young age. So mm-hmm. I think I was late 29 when I conceived and 30 when I gave birth. And it's a lot. I mean, mm-hmm. Now I think about what it would be like to have another child, and I really swing back and forth about whether or not I'd want to do that. Mm. Because I think of how lucky I am to have a full life, not thinking about disability or disease for a second. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to slow down or give anything else up, because something to make room, at least when I think about it in the abstract, something has to go away.
Yeah, that's a principle that I speak of a lot when I talk to artists about like planning and goal setting. And
yeah,
you know, we run a virtual residency program. And I'm always like, if you're going to commit to 6 weeks of work, what are you going to take away? Because all of our lives are full, you know, and to add something, it's like so romantic to add something, right? But the reality is that either by force or, you know, just by circumstance, something will have to be deprioritized in the process.
Right. And it just feels like somehow I've struck a rhythm and like a very feminist, egalitarian conversation and life with my husband where we have a lot of respect and dialogue about compromise. I feel like that's been the key to all of this. I always tell my husband, shout out to Topher Horn, that there's no I without we. Which is kind of embarrassing to have just said, but it's true.
It's not embarrassing. It made me teary-eyed.
I don't know. I think when I became a parent, I also became more type A, where I used the calendar in a way that would have been unimaginable to me 10 years ago. And I'm in therapy. And I also, I realized this just last week that my practice has become much less based on systems. And by that, I mean, like, as a patient, I've always had a full-time job. And when I started photographing in my infusion suite, it was like, I don't need to punish myself for not working because everything I do in my day job is part of my creative practice. It's research. But then also when I'm in the hospital, that's when I'm photographing. And so the system was just kind of like that 28-day cycle of that's when pictures are being made. And then at some future time, there'll be the editing and sequencing and whatever comes afterward. But now I have a five-year-old who has her own social calendar. And I have a wonderful marriage and friend group. And it's just kind of like, I actually need to start using my calendar to schedule studio time. I need to start using my calendar. I need to go more granular and use my calendar to schedule like a 3-hour block of going out to photograph, which is something I haven't done before. And I will say very upfront to everyone listening, I thought that I work on really a semester schedule, and I thought that after the spring semester, spring of 2024, after that ended and my kids started day camp, I would be in my studio every day. But today, Tuesday, December 17th, I have been in my studio maybe 4 times since June. And there have been various life events that have happened, but I really, in hindsight, see that as not using my calendar in the way that I can now see it needs to be really used to schedule studio time.
Yeah, it needs like a hard time block, you know. I'm thinking about that as we enter into the new year of, you know, what's it going to look like? Because whatever I was doing last year didn't really get me the results that I was hoping for. And, you know, one of the things that I'm thinking about is a day or two of the week that it's just studio. That's it. Yeah. Like, I'm not spending half the morning answering emails, you know, like there has to be kind of like stronger boundaries, put up to protect it, I think. Because when you have other jobs and responsibilities and things, you know, it's just so easy to put it in front of, like, we're so results oriented, you know, that something that is more about the practice, about the journey, it's just harder to like commit.
Yeah. May I ask you, how many children do you have?
I have three, and they are 6, 8, and 12. And there are things about it that get easier, but to your point about your daughter now having a social calendar, I have three kids who are in activities. I mean, we just spent this past weekend, you know, a day and a half, we were out of town, like supporting my oldest at a jazz festival. And, you know, like the time commitment, it doesn't really decrease. Like it shifts so that, you know, particularly if you put your children in school, right, you have that school time. But I mean, yeah, like 3:30 to 9 p.m. is family time, you know? I mean, up until my almost 13-year-old goes to bed at 9:30 and we've just spent an hour watching a show together and I'm now tired. And it's like, it's like in some ways, it's like the studio practice just cycles back around where you're like, well, am I going to make work from 10 p.m. to midnight? Or what? You're like, what am I going to do here? You know, the answer is no, but so I don't know. It's wonderful though, because I just, and I'm sure you've noticed this with your 5-year-old, that they start to have a better understanding and appreciation for like the work that you do. And they can, you know, I can communicate a boundary that I need to have with my kids, and they get it so much more than when they were, you know, younger than 5.
Yeah.
So that is helpful, at least. But yeah, it's a lot. And you know, I think for you also that cycle of the 28 days, right? Like, I'd love for you to just talk about that a little bit more in relationship to your creative practice and, you know, because I'm sure your health affects your energy, your ability, your inspiration. But also, yeah. I think it's interesting that, like you said, you brought up the word system, that you have kind of this system and this rhythm that you can work within, which is really helpful for artists, actually. So to use that, you know, that ritual of, you know, your 28-day IV infusion as like a marker for your next phase of your creative cycle too, is just like really, I mean, I don't mean this to sound contrite, but it's like actually really lovely to me to think of it in this way of how you're embracing it.
Yeah. So the New York Times piece came out in June of 2023. I think. And after that, my infusion cycle switched. I changed medications, and which I didn't expect or know would happen. But I'm now on a more of a 6-month cycle.
Okay.
And it has, like, there can be variation where every 6 months there'll be two weeks apart. But it's, even with its consistency, it has some inconsistencies. And there's a huge, significant rather, part of me that really misses that cycle of art making. And when
how
I was,
long did you document that, the 28-day, like, I'm not sure what you call that project, but
It's kind of the title is still tentatively Our Body as a Clock, but I think of them really as the infusion pictures.
Yeah.
And I think my first infusion was a home infusion at the very beginning of 2015. And I'm still photographing. It's just that the frequencies changed.
Okay.
But when I started, especially when I started bringing in my big camera, that was a huge jump in how I felt about the process, because there was something about it that I was taking the process more seriously. I wasn't sneaking around, trying not to be seen making pictures. When I would come through security, there would be new security guards, and I often feel nervous that people will see the tripod and think it's a weapon or something, in part because I don't have a lot of exposure to weapons. So to me, it does kind of look like a weapon. But so I'll walk through security and I'll say, "This is a tripod," just so there's no that I can be more active. And one of the new security guards at that particular visit said, "Oh yes, I see right here the only patient who comes in with a full set of backpacks to bring recording equipment into their appointments," or something like that. But I felt so that started in 2020, and I just felt so much more empowered. Like I was using that time. I think the way I've written about it or talked about it before is that I'm reclaiming that time as an artist and as a photographer to be more in control of that aspect of being a patient, where really once you step into a medical setting, you're really just waiting, and you become more or less your body becomes an object. And it can be scary, very vulnerable, but I was able to work with those things as ingredients to my pictures. And I was really fortunate that all of the nurses, for the most part, were almost collaborators and really supportive. And a lot of the other patients were curious about what I was doing. And often there would be conversations kind of about an economy of sickness, where it was an infusion center and mainly cancer patients, and it would often be someone on chemotherapy telling me that they felt sorry for me because I had it so much worse than they did. So there is an aspect of the project that is just writing, which hasn't had as much attention, in part because I don't feel comfortable putting it on my website. But there's writing to capture aspects of this whole experience that can't be seen in pictures. And at some future time, there will be a book that includes writing and text. And I think that will be when a person can access it.
I think it's about time you booked an art residency at Kin House Artist Residency. Like Hannah Chalou talked about in episode 162 of the Artist Mother podcast, it's so important to have time and space apart from your regular life to not only make your work, but to rest, to read, and to think about your work. Residencies can afford this experience for artist parents, whether you bring your kiddos or not. Coming out of your routine and settling into a space that has been set up for you to rest, to be inspired, to reflect, and to make your work in a focused way can be career changing. I run an artist residency in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and the Kin House Artist Residency is really committed to inclusivity. We are family friendly, There's no fee to apply. There's no hierarchy between emerging and established artists. And all of our residency fees are based on a household income sliding scale. Our residency is gender inclusive, and our one-week residencies include the entire two-story, three-bedroom home, use of a detached art studio, use of a basement art studio, Wi-Fi, washer, dryer, kitchen, backyard with fire pit, back deck, front porch, and common areas. Residency does not include travel, food, or art supplies. You've got to bring those things or provide them on your own. We love our neighborhood where our art residency house is situated in our walkable Southwood Park in Fort Wayne. The house is within walking distance from some of our favorite neighborhood joints, and there's a park nearby with walking and running trails, gardens, and a large playground if you decide to bring your kids. We would love for you to consider booking a residency with us in 2025. Residencies are booked 1 week at a time, but you can also extend your residency to 2 weeks. You can either bring your family or, my recommendation, bring a few artist friends, share the cost, share the space, and have an incredibly inspiring week together. Join us at Kinhouse Artist Residency. You can find out more and book your spot today, kinhouseart.com/residency. Who are some artists who also have made work about the intersection of self and chronic illness that have either supported you or who, you know, whether directly or indirectly? I'm asking that because I see your work as so needed because of the visibility aspect of, you know, literally making something visible that is often behind closed doors, right? And the double duty of that being caregiving and, you know, chronic illness and somebody going through treatment in a society where we often, you know, struggle to be vulnerable about the burdens that we're carrying.
Yeah. For a long time, and still, the work of Carolyn Lazard, they've made a lot of work about chronic illness, but the first pieces that really resonated with me they're called In Sickness and in Study. And I think the project is ongoing, but they're images of Carolyn receiving medical infusions while reading really, they're often reading books that are very intellectually rigorous. So like, I can't name any of them at the moment, but Crip theory or Black Marxist theory or, you know, things that show them as not being a passive patient, but one who is using this time of infusion to also infuse themselves cerebrally with information to empower them. And at that point, Carolyn was posting them on Instagram, and it gave me this courage to think about putting myself on the internet in this capacity, in the capacity of like being a medical patient. Also the work of Park MacArthur, and I have found a lot of kinship with artists of many disciplines who are working in the disability and accessibility space. Trying to think of other photographers specifically.
Have you felt like there have been times as an artist where the art world and things that you wanted to experience could have been made more accessible to you?
I don't know yet. Also the work of Finnegan Shannon, whose work I really love, because a lot of their projects have to do with just literally making more space for people to sit down and enjoy art, and how the museum and the gallery space can be inaccessible. Just in one way of thinking, there's nowhere to sit and rest while you're looking at these things. In regard to the question you just asked before I started talking about Finnegan, I don't know. I think it's been really tricky because I've been trying to get financial support for a book project, and I don't know, like in my most vulnerable moments, I don't know if I'm not receiving support because the work isn't good enough, or if I'm not receiving support because making art about illness is not something that people find worthy or interesting or
sexy.
Yeah, sexy. It sort of provokes thoughts of the own viewer's mortality and vulnerability, and people don't really want to think about that.
Even in the art world, which is, you know, what I think a lot of people would say the art world is supposed to do, is point us towards those things that we generally don't want to engage with. But I certainly understand your perspective, and I see it too, that there's still these, you know, I think the term I said earlier was like closed door, right?
Yeah. And you also mentioned the phrase, you talked about the silencing, or maybe the, you used the word silencing, because I was just talking with another artist mother. I was talking to a married couple, and they're the Rathkopfs, Jordan Rathkopf and Anna Rathkopf. And they just put out a book together. It's called Her Too. It was published by Daylight, I think earlier this year. And both of them are looking at Anna's experience of cancer, I think before 50. And part of what Anna and I were saying to each other is about how there's, what we were saying was a double silencing, where you start telling people about your illness and they project their own emotions and experience of something onto you. And so that's one silencing. And then after maybe you are in a remission or in a stable state, then there's another silencing of illness because you're okay. And really, I think we could continue to layer on the silencing, because in some ways it's just an inability to have a dialogue about the temporary state of this wild and wonderful life that we have.
Speaking of silencing, I'm curious about some of the conversations that you've had with your daughter about these things, about your art making, about your journey with MS, your partnership that helps support you through these things. Just, I don't know, anything notable that you've discovered as you've processed this? Like, I find as a parent, you know, sometimes I don't know how I think about something until I have to process it with my own kids. You know, I can say things to other adults that I usually am pretty truthful, but the real self-reflection is like when I'm engaging with my kids in conversation, you know, I don't know, anything.
Yeah.
Or even just like those moments of your daughter being there with you in treatment and
Yeah, it's been a while since we've talked about it. I think really in 2023, she wasn't four yet. And so I stopped going every 28 days. And before that change, she was asking a lot of questions. And she's seen some of the pictures now because the project has about 13,000 images in it. And she's seen maybe 60 of them. And she's seen the New York Times piece. We have it framed in our living room.
As you should.
And the questions about that have kind of dropped off for the time being. But when I go to the doctor now, I have to travel into New York City. It's a whole day affair. And when I come back, have like a bandage on, and she's curious about the bandage. And one time she said to me, when I'm grown up, will I be getting that medicine too? And I think I said something like, I received this medicine to help keep me healthy and safe. And if you need medicine someday to help keep you healthy and safe, I will help you get that medicine to the best of my ability, but I really hope you don't need it. And I've talked to her about what the disease is, but she's still so small.
Yeah, five is pretty young.
And more recently, my dad died in October, and it was pretty surprising, but really processing that through conversation with her is totally fascinating, and challenging and humbling and amazing. And I imagine a future where we're really having conversations like the ones we're having right now about death, about illness and receiving care for a chronic illness like MS.
Thanks, Sarah. I want to bring us back full circle to end our conversation and talk about photo books, actually, because I obviously your work as a photographer in an image-driven society, there's like a lot there. And you talked about the ways in which you are careful to share your work, both related to the storytelling and the text. But also I know that, even looking at your Instagram and some of the places that you've been published, that it's easy these days to share an image, but that image is so easily taken out of context in a body of work with 13,000 photographs, like there's just a lot there. And I guess I'm making the assumption that the object of the photo book is something that is really important to your practice and the ways in which you want people to engage with your work. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that and some of the things as a photographer that you try to prioritize in terms of like viewership and people understanding and getting to experience your work.
Yes. So I have really loved photo books since my second year of college, which was around 2007. And at that point, really just looking at books and having an incredible teacher, Terry Weifenbach, who herself is a really incredible photographer and bookmaker. I knew, or I was learning then, that you could create a whole world within a book that creates a context for itself. It becomes very concerned with the world within those book boards. And I think I made, at the end of my undergraduate work, I made a book, and I felt really good about it. and I was eager to keep making books. And 4 years later, I made one. And I've continued to make them. And I'm just fascinated by how you can be a hunter out in the world with your camera, making pictures, and then create a strategy for editing, and then create a sort of rationality for your sequence. Mm. I mean, there are certain things that I maybe argue are rule-based about, like making that edit and selection. But it feels very playful for mm-hmm. me to create whatever the rules are for each individual book. When I make pictures, I really think about how the picture that I'm working on, photograph that I'm working on, might integrate or connect to pictures that I've already made. So I'm thinking actively in my mind's eye about a sequence and what happens when you turn the page of a book and an image is behind you, but still active in your mind, and how the one I'm making might sort of be another word in the sentence. Because I think of a book as like a more
story,
complete
thought, like you're telling a story. Yeah.
Even though I don't think it's always narrative.
Right.
The book is always narrative. And so there can be this kind of frustration on the part of the person looking at a book where it's like, I don't know what this is about. Because I think we're really indoctrinated to feel as though we need to understand what stuff is about. Mm-hmm. And not always what that story, as we've been saying, makes us feel.
Mm-hmm.
It's really getting in touch with what something makes you feel is a much slower process.
Mm-hmm.
And we live in a time of incredible immediacy.
Yes. So, yes, we do.
So, I have been really lucky. I've gotten to make a few books, and I work with people who want to make their own books. And so I'm thinking about visual books a lot. And I just made one where the pages are loose and it's unbound. And in the back, there's like a zine leaflet that explains what the book is. And there's a conversation between my dad and me where his voice is in his handwriting. So I did a lot of things that I would say are experimental and maybe weird. But it was fun to do something that is outside of what people expect of this, like, finely, you know, hardcover book,
polished.
Very polished, just like a little rougher, a little bit more of an experiment. So
awesome. Thanks for sharing. Sarah, I always close every episode with 5 questions for folks to get to know you a little bit better. You can answer these as briefly as you want. Don't think too hard. Who's your biggest art crush?
My biggest art crush currently is Moira Davey.
What is your favorite place to travel or a dream trip that you'd like to go on?
I'd like to go to Japan.
Tell me a film or a book that has been a big inspiration to you.
Can it be a song?
Sure.
There's this song by David Lang called Just After Song of Songs, and it's maybe a 13-minute song. And when I listen to it, it helps loosen me up to cry. And I really want the book that I make next, and I think this every time, but I really want the book that I make next to evoke the feeling of that song.
That's wonderful. What is your favorite meal?
I love soup.
Me too.
And when we started this call, I was eating a zuppa toscana, which I just had for the first time. Cream, spinach, carrots. Really good.
Good. And finally, who do you want to give a shout out to for supporting you in your work?
I would like to give a shout out to Zhenya Fridland, who is another artist mom who has helped me think about my work and think about models for being a successful artist and parent and partner to their husband. And I'm grateful to them for all their support and friendship.
I want to circle back to the artist. I remembered who the artist was that I said I also curated them from popping into Candela. It was Anna Rohde. So shout out to Anna Rohde, who is an artist, I think, who used to be based in New Mexico, but maybe is in Massachusetts now. I'll link to Anna's work. And
yeah, I wrote about Anna's book recently for PhotoEye.
That book is so stunning. I own a copy of it. The one with the little cutouts. I love it so much.
Yeah.
Okay, Sarah, where can people connect with you and find you or view your work?
We can connect on Instagram. My Instagram is Sarah J. Winston. You can find my website also, Sarah J. Winston, or email me at sarahjwinston@gmail.com. And I'm really excited for anyone in Richmond or nearby. I'm going to have my very first solo exhibition at Candela this March. So you can find out more about that on Candela's site.
Awesome. And again, big shout out to Candela and the artists in that area who have connected us. So, Sarah, thank you so much. I feel like we just kind of scratched the surface. I would love to keep chatting, but, podcast length is something to consider. So really appreciate your time and your sharing.
Definitely.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much.
The Artist Mother podcast is curated and produced by Kaylin Butine. Music by Josh Middleton. Editing and mixing by John M. Butine. Please visit www.artistmotherpodcast.com for episode notes and to find out how you can further support this podcast.